and he wanted to marry me, what would my answer be? Anne, be honest. You wouldn't be able to marry him, but it's so hard to let go. Peter still has too little character, too little willpower, too little courage and strength. He's still a child, emotionally no older than I am. All he wants is happiness and peace of mind. Am I really only 14? Am I really just a silly schoolgirl? Am I really so inexperienced in everything? I have more experience than most. I've experienced something almost no one my age ever has. I'm afraid of myself. Afraid my longing is making me yield too soon. How can it ever go right with other boys later on? Oh, it's so hard, the eternal struggle between heart and mind. There's a time and a place for both, but how can I be sure that I've chosen the right time? Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, May 2nd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Saturday night I asked Peter whether he thinks I should tell Father about us. After we'd discussed it, he said he thought I should. I was glad. It shows he's sensible and sensitive. As soon as I came downstairs, I went with Father to get some water. While we were on the stairs, I said, Father, I'm sure you've gathered that when Peter and I are together, we don't exactly sit at opposite ends of the room. Do you think that's wrong? Father paused before answering. No, I don't think it's wrong. But Anne, when you're living so close together as we do, you have to be careful. He said some other words to that effect, and then we went upstairs. Sunday morning he called me to him and said, Anne, I've been thinking about what you said. Oh, I knew what was coming. Here in the annex, it's not such a good idea. I thought you were just friends. Is Peter in love with you? Of course not, I answered. Well, you know I understand both of you, but you must be the one to show restraint. Don't go upstairs so often, don't encourage him more than you can help. In matters like these, it's always the man who takes the active role, and it's up to the woman to set the limits. Outside, where you're free, things are quite different. You see other boys and girls, you can go outdoors, take part in sports and all kinds of activities. But here, if you're together too much and want to get away, you can't. You see each other every hour of the day, all the time, in fact. Be careful, Anne, and don't take it too seriously. I don't, Father, but Peter's a decent boy, a nice boy. Yes, but he doesn't have much strength of character. He can easily be influenced to do good, but also to do bad. I hope for his sake that he stays good, because he's basically a good person. We talked some more and agreed that Father would speak to him, too. Sunday afternoon, when we were in the front attic, Peter asked, Have you talked to your father yet, Anne? Yes, I replied. I'll tell you all about it. He doesn't think it's wrong, but he says that here, where we're in such close quarters, it could lead to conflicts. We've already agreed not to quarrel, and I plan to keep my promise. Me too, Peter, but Father didn't think we were serious. He thought we were just friends. Do you think we still can be? Yes, I do. How about you? Me too. I also told Father that I trust you. I do trust you, Peter, just as much as I do Father. And I think you're worthy of my trust. You are, aren't you? I hope so. He was very shy and blushing. I believe in you, Peter, I continued. I believe you have a good character and that you'll get ahead in this world. After that, we talked about other things. Later, I said, If we ever get out of here, I know you won't give me another thought. He got all fired up. That's not true, Anne. Oh, no. I won't let you even think that about me. Just then, somebody called us. Father did talk to him, he told me Monday. Your father thought our friendship might turn into love, he said. But I told him we'd keep ourselves under control. Father wants me to stop going upstairs so often, but I don't want to. Not just because I like being with Peter, but because I've said I trust him. I do trust him, and I want to prove it to him, but I'll never be able to if I stay downstairs out of distrust. No, I'm going. In the meantime, the Dussel drama has been resolved. Saturday evening at dinner, he apologized in beautiful Dutch. Mr. Van Dan was immediately reconciled. Dussel must have spent all day practicing his speech. Sunday, his birthday, passed without incident. We gave him a bottle of good wine from 1919. The Van Dans, who can now give their gift after all, presented him with a jar of pickalilli and a package of razor blades, and Mr. Kugler gave him a jar of lemon syrup to make lemonade. Meep a book, Little Martin, and Bep a plant. He treated everyone to an egg. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, May 3rd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, first the weekly news. We're having a vacation from politics. There's nothing, and I mean absolutely nothing, to report. I'm also gradually starting to believe that the invasion will come. After all, they can't let the Russians do all the dirty work. Actually, the Russians aren't doing anything at the moment either. Mr. Kleiman comes to the office every morning now. He got a new set of springs for Peter's divan, so Peter will have to get to work reupholstering it. Not surprisingly, he isn't at all in the mood. Mr. Kleiman also brought some flea powder for the cats. Have I told you that our Bosch has disappeared? We haven't seen hide nor hair of her since last Thursday. She's probably already in cat heaven, while some animal lover has turned her into a tasty dish. Perhaps some girl who can afford it will be wearing a cap made of Bosch's fur. Peter is heartbroken. For the last 2 weeks, we've been eating lunch at 11:30 on Saturdays. In the mornings, we have to make do with a cup of hot cereal. Starting tomorrow, it'll be like this every day. That saves us a meal. Vegetables are still very hard to come by. This afternoon, we had rotten boiled lettuce. Ordinary lettuce, spinach, and boiled lettuce. That's all there is. Add to that rotten potatoes, and you have a meal fit for a king. I hadn't had my period for more than 2 months, but it finally started last Sunday. Despite the mess and bother, I'm glad it hasn't deserted me. As you can no doubt imagine, we often say in despair, what's the point of the war? Why, oh why, can't people live together peacefully? Why all this destruction? The question is understandable, but up to now no one has come up with a satisfactory answer. Why is England manufacturing bigger and better airplanes and bombs and at the same time churning out new houses for reconstruction? Why are millions spent on the war each day while not a penny is available for medical science, artists, or the poor? Why do people have to starve when mountains of food are rotting away in other parts of the world? Oh, why are people so crazy? I don't believe the war is simply the work of politicians and capitalists. Oh, no, the common man is every bit as guilty. Otherwise, people and nations would have rebelled long ago. There's a destructive urge in people, the urge to rage, murder, and kill. And until all of humanity, without exception, undergoes a metamorphosis, wars will continue to be waged, and everything that has been carefully built up, cultivated, and grown will be cut down and destroyed, only to start all over again. I've often been down in the dumps, but never desperate. I look upon our life in hiding as an interesting adventure, full of danger and romance, and every privation as an amusing addition to my diary. I've made up my mind to lead a different life from other girls and not to become an ordinary housewife later on. What I'm experiencing here is a good beginning to an interesting life, and that's the reason, the only reason, why I have to laugh at the humorous side of the most dangerous moments. I'm young and have many hidden qualities. I'm young and strong and living through a big adventure. I'm right in the middle of it and can't spend all day complaining because it's impossible to have any fun. I'm blessed with many things. Happiness, a cheerful disposition, and strength. Every day I feel myself maturing. I feel liberation drawing nearer. I feel the beauty of nature and the goodness of the people around me. Every day I think what a fascinating and amusing adventure this is. With all that, why should I despair? Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, May 5th, 1944. Dear Kitty, Father's unhappy with me. After our talk on Sunday, he thought I'd stop going upstairs every evening. He won't have any of that knutcherei going on. I can't stand that word. Talking about it was bad enough. Why does he have to make me feel bad, too? I'll have a word with him today. Margot gave me some good advice. Here's more or less what I'd like to say. I think you expect an explanation from me, Father, so I'll give you one. You're disappointed in me. You expected more restraint from me. You no doubt want me to act the way a 14-year-old is supposed to, but that's where you're wrong. Since we've been here, from July 1942 until a few weeks ago, I haven't had an easy time. If only you knew how much I used to cry at night, how unhappy and despondent I was, how lonely I felt, you'd understand my wanting to go upstairs. I've now reached the point where I don't need the support of Mother or anyone else. It didn't happen overnight. I've struggled long and hard and shed many tears to become as independent as I am now. You can laugh and refuse to believe me, but I don't care. I know I'm an independent person, and I don't feel I need to account to you for my actions. I'm only telling you this because I don't want you to think I'm doing things behind your back. But there's only one person I'm accountable to, and that's me. When I was having problems, everyone, and that includes you, closed their eyes and ears and didn't help me. On the contrary, all I ever got were admonitions not to be so noisy. I was noisy only to keep myself from being miserable all the time. I was overconfident to keep from having to listen to the voice inside me. I've been putting on an act for the last year and a half, day in, day out. I've never complained or dropped my mask, nothing of the kind, and now the battle is over. I've won. I'm independent in both body and mind. I don't need a mother anymore, and I've emerged from the struggle a stronger person. Now that it's over, now that I know the battle has been won, I want to go my own way, to follow the path that seems right to me. Don't think of me as a 14-year-old, since all these troubles have made me older. I won't regret my actions. I'll behave the way I think I should. Gentle persuasion won't keep me from going upstairs. You'll either have to forbid it, or trust me through thick and thin. Whatever you do, just leave me alone. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, May 6th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, last night before dinner I tucked the letter I'd written into Father's pocket. According to Margot, he read it and was upset for the rest of the evening. I was upstairs doing the dishes. Poor Pim. I might have known what the effect of such an epistle would be. He's so sensitive. I immediately told Peter not to ask any questions or say anything more. Pim said nothing else to me about the matter. Is he going to? Everything here is more or less back to normal. We can hardly believe what Jan, Mr. Kugler, and Mr. Kleiman tell us about the prices and the people on the outside. Half a pound of tea cost 350 guilders. Half a pound of coffee, 80 guilders. A pound of butter, 35 guilders. One egg, 1 gilder, 45 cents. People are paying 14 guilders an ounce for Bulgarian tobacco. Everyone's trading on the black market. Every errand boy has something to offer. The delivery boy from the bakery has supplied us with darning thread, 90 cents for one measly skein. The milkman can get hold of ration books. An undertaker delivers cheese. Break-ins, murders, and thefts are daily occurrences. Even the police and night watchmen are getting in on the act. Everyone wants to put food in their stomachs, and since salaries have been frozen, people have had to resort to swindling. The police have their hands full trying to track down the many girls of 15, 16, 17, and older who are reported missing every day. I want to try to finish my story about Ellen, the fairy. Just for fun, I can give it to Father on his birthday, together with all the copyrights. See you later. Actually, that's not the right phrase. In the German program broadcast from England, they always close with Auf Wiederhören. So I guess I should say, until we write again. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Sunday morning, May 7th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Father and I had a long talk yesterday afternoon. I cried my eyes out, and he cried too. Do you know what he said to me, Kitty? I've received many letters in my lifetime, but none as hurtful as this. You, who have had so much love from your parents, you, whose parents have always been ready to help you, who have always defended you no matter what, you talk of not having to account to us for your actions. You feel you've been wronged and left to your own devices. No, Anne, you've done us a great injustice. Perhaps you didn't mean it that way, but that's what you wrote. No, Anne, we have done nothing to deserve such a reproach. Oh, I've failed miserably. This is the worst thing I've ever done in my entire life. I used my tears to show off, to make myself seem important so he'd respect me. I've certainly had my share of unhappiness, and everything I said about Mother is true. But to accuse Pym, who's so good and who's done everything for me, no, that was too cruel for words. It's good that somebody has finally cut me down to size, has broken my pride, because I've been far too smug. Not everything Mistress Anne does is good. Anyone who deliberately causes such pain to someone they say they love is despicable, the lowest of the low. What I'm most ashamed of is the way Father has forgiven me. He said he's going to throw the letter in the stove, and he's being so nice to me now, as if he were the one who'd done something wrong. Well, Anne, you still have a lot to learn. It's time you made a beginning instead of looking down at other people and always blaming them. I've known a lot of sorrow, but who hasn't at my age? I've been putting on an act, but was hardly even aware of it. I felt lonely, but never desperate. Not like Father, who once ran out into the street with a knife so he could put an end to it all. I've never gone that far. I should be deeply ashamed of myself. And I am. What's done can't be undone, but at least you can keep it from happening again. I'd like to start all over, and that shouldn't be difficult, now that I have Peter. With him supporting me, I know I can do it. I'm not alone anymore. He loves me, I love him. I have my books, my writing, and my diary. I'm not all that ugly, or that stupid. I have a sunny disposition, and I want to develop a good character. Yes, Anne, you knew full well that your letter was unkind and untrue, but you were actually proud of it. I'll take Father as my example once again, and I will improve myself. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, May 8th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, have I ever told you anything about our family? I don't think I have, so let me begin. Father was born in Frankfurt on Main to very wealthy parents. Michael Frank owned a bank and became a millionaire, and Alice Stern's parents were prominent and well-to-do. Michael Frank didn't start out rich. He was a self-made man. In his youth, Father led the life of a rich man's son. Parties every week, balls, banquets, beautiful girls, waltzing, dinners, a huge house, etc. After Grandpa died, most of the money was lost. And after the Great War and inflation, there was nothing left at all. Up until the war, there were still quite a few rich relatives. So Father was extremely well-bred, and he had to laugh yesterday because for the first time in his 55 years, he scraped out the frying pan at the table. Mother's family wasn't as wealthy, but still fairly well off, and we've listened open-mouthed to stories of private balls, dinners, and engagement parties with 250 guests. We're far from rich now, but I've pinned all my hopes on after the war. I can assure you, I'm not so set on a bourgeois life as Mother and Margot. I'd like to spend a year in Paris and London learning the languages and studying art history. Compare that with Margot, who wants to nurse newborns in Palestine. I still have visions of gorgeous dresses and fascinating people. As I've told you many times before, I want to see the world and do all kinds of exciting things, and a little money won't hurt. This morning, Meep told us about her cousin's engagement party, which she went to on Saturday. The cousin's parents are rich, and the grooms are even richer. Meep made our mouths water, telling us about the food that was served. Vegetable soup with meatballs, cheese, rolls with sliced meat, hors d'oeuvres made with eggs and roast beef, rolls with cheese, Genoise, wine, and cigarettes, and you could eat as much as you wanted. Meep drank 10 schnapps and smoked 3 cigarettes. Could this be our temperance advocate? If Meep drank all those, I wonder how many her spouse managed to toss down. Everyone at the party was a little tipsy, of course. There were also 2 officers from the homicide squad who took photographs of the wedding couple. You can see we're never far from Meep's thoughts, since she promptly noted their names and addresses in case anything should happen and we needed contacts with good Dutch people. Our mouths were watering so much. We, who'd had nothing but 2 spoonfuls of hot cereal for breakfast and were absolutely famished. We, who get nothing but half-cooked spinach for the vitamins and rotten potatoes day after day. We, who fill our empty stomachs with nothing but boiled lettuce, raw lettuce, spinach, spinach, and more spinach. Maybe we'll end up being as strong as Popeye, though up to now I've seen no sign of it. If Meep had taken us along to the party, there wouldn't have been any rolls left over for the other guests. If we'd been there, we'd have snatched up everything in sight, including the furniture. I tell you, we were practically pulling the words right out of her mouth. We were gathered around her as if we'd never in all our lives heard of delicious food or elegant people. And these are the granddaughters of the distinguished millionaire. The world is a crazy place. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, May 9th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I've finished my story about Ellen the fairy. I've copied it out on nice notepaper, decorated it with red ink, and sewn the pages together. The whole thing looks quite pretty, but I don't know if it's enough of a birthday present. Margot and Mother have both written poems. Mr. Kugler came upstairs this afternoon with the news that starting Monday, Mrs. Brox would like to spend 2 hours in the office every afternoon. Just imagine, the office staff won't be able to come upstairs. The potatoes can't be delivered. Bep won't get her dinner. We can't go to the bathroom. We won't be able to move and all sorts of other inconveniences. We proposed a variety of ways to get rid of her. Mr. Van Dam thought a good laxative in her coffee might do the trick. No, Mr. Kleiman answered. Please don't, or we'll never get her off the can. A roar of laughter. The can? Mrs. Van D asked. What does that mean? An explanation was given. Is it all right to use that word? She asked in perfect innocence. Just imagine, Bep giggled. There you are shopping at the Bayenkorf, and you ask the way to the can. They wouldn't even know what you were talking about. Dussel now sits on the can, to borrow the expression, every day at 12:30 on the dot. This afternoon I boldly took a piece of pink paper and wrote, Mr. Dussel's toilet timetable. Mornings from 7:15 to 7:30 a.m. Afternoons after 1 p.m. Otherwise, only as needed. I tacked this to the green bathroom door while he was still inside. I might well have added transgressors will be subject to confinement, because our bathroom can be locked from both the inside and the outside. Mr. Van Dan's latest joke. After a Bible lesson about Adam and Eve, a 13-year-old boy asked his father, Tell me, father, how did I get born? Well, the father replied, The stork plucked you out of the ocean, set you down in mother's bed, and bit her in the leg hard. It bled so much, she had to stay in bed for a week. Not fully satisfied, the boy went to his mother. Tell me, mother, he asked, how did you get born and how did I get born? His mother told him the very same story. Finally, hoping to hear the fine points, he went to his grandfather. Tell me, grandfather, he said, how did you get born and how did your daughter get born? And for the third time, he was told exactly the same story. That night, he wrote in his diary, After careful inquiry, I must conclude that there has been no sexual intercourse in our family for the last 3 generations. I still have work to do. It's already 3 o'clock. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. Since I think I've mentioned the new cleaning lady, I just want to note that she's married, 60 years old, and hard of hearing. Very convenient in view of all the noise that 8 people in hiding are capable of making. Oh, Kit, it's such lovely weather. If only I could go outside. Wednesday, May 10th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, we were sitting in the attic yesterday afternoon working on our French when suddenly I heard the splatter of water behind me. I asked Peter what it might be. Without pausing to reply, he dashed up to the loft, the scene of the disaster, and he shoved Mushi, who was squatting beside her soggy litter box, back to the right place. This was followed by shouts and squeals, and then Mushi, who by that time had finished peeing, took off downstairs. In search of something similar to her box, Mushi had found herself a pile of wood shavings right over a crack in the floor. The puddle immediately trickled down to the attic and, as luck would have it, landed in and next to the potato barrel. The ceiling was dripping, and since the attic floor has also got its share of cracks, little yellow drops were leaking through the ceiling and onto the dining table, between a pile of stockings and books. I was doubled up with laughter. It was such a funny sight. There was Mushi, crouched under a chair, Peter armed with water, powdered bleach, and a cloth, and Mr. Van Dan trying to calm everyone down. The room was soon set to rights, but it's a well-known fact that cat puddles stink to high heaven. The potatoes proved that all too well, as did the wood shavings, which Father collected in a bucket and brought downstairs to burn. Poor Mushi! How were you to know it's impossible to get peat for your box? Anne. Thursday, May 11th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, a new sketch to make you laugh. Peter's hair had to be cut, and as usual, his mother was to be the hairdresser. At 7:25, Peter vanished into his room and reappeared at the stroke of 7:30, stripped down to his blue swimming trunks and a pair of tennis shoes. "Are you coming?" he asked his mother. "Yes, I'll be up in a minute, but I can't find the scissors." Peter helped her look, rummaging around in her cosmetics drawer. "Don't make such a mess, Peter," she grumbled. I didn't catch Peter's reply, but it must have been insolent, because she cuffed him on the arm. He cuffed her back. She punched him with all her might, and Peter pulled his arm away with a look of mock horror on his face. "Come on, old girl." Mrs. Van D stayed put. Peter grabbed her by the wrists and pulled her all around the room. She laughed, cried, scolded, and kicked, but nothing helped. Peter led his prisoner as far as the attic stairs, where he was obliged to let go of her. Mrs. Van D came back to the room and collapsed into a chair with a loud sigh.
"Die Entführung der Mutter," I joked.
"Yes, but he hurt me." I went to have a look and cooled her hot red wrists with water. Peter, still by the stairs and growing impatient again, strode into the room with his belt in his hand, like a lion tamer. Mrs. Van D didn't move, but stayed by her writing desk, looking for a handkerchief. "You've got to apologize first."
"All right, I hereby offer my apologies, but only because if I don't, we'll be here till midnight."
Mrs. Van D had to laugh in spite of herself. She got up and went toward the door, where she felt obliged to give us an explanation. By us, I mean Father, Mother, and me. We were busy doing the dishes.
"He wasn't like this at home," she said.
"I'd have belted him so hard he'd have gone flying down the stairs. He's never been so insolent. This isn't the first time he's deserved a good hiding. That's what you get with a modern upbringing, modern children. I'd never have grabbed my mother like that.
Did you treat your mother that way, Mr. Frank?"
She was very upset, pacing back and forth, saying whatever came into her head, and she still hadn't gone upstairs. Finally, at long last, she made her exit. Less than 5 minutes later, she stormed back down the stairs, with her cheeks all puffed out, and flung her apron on a chair.
When I asked if she was through, she replied that she was going downstairs.
She tore down the stairs like a tornado, probably straight into the arms of her pootie. She didn't come up again until 8, this time with her husband. Peter was dragged from the attic, given a merciless scolding and showered with abuse. "Ill-mannered brat, no good bum, bad example, and this, Margot that." I couldn't hear the rest. Everything seems to have calmed down again today. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. Tuesday and Wednesday evenings, our beloved queen addressed the country. She's taking a vacation, so she'll be in good health for her return to the Netherlands. She used words like soon, when I'm back in Holland, a swift liberation, heroism, and heavy burdens. This was followed by a speech by Prime Minister Gabrandi. He has such a squeaky little child's voice that Mother instinctively said, "Ooh." A clergyman, who must have borrowed his voice from Mr. Edel, concluded by asking God to take care of the Jews, all those in concentration camps and prisons and everyone working in Germany. Thursday, May 11th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, since I've left my entire junk box, including my fountain pen, upstairs and I'm not allowed to disturb the grown-ups during their nap time, until 2:30, you'll have to make do with a letter and pencil. I'm terribly busy at the moment, and strange as it may sound, I don't have enough time to get through my pile of work. Shall I tell you briefly what I've got to do? Well then, before tomorrow, I have to finish reading the first volume of a biography of Galileo Galilei, since it has to be returned to the library. I started reading it yesterday and have gotten up to page 220 out of 320 pages, so I'll manage it. Next week, I have to read Palestine at the Crossroads and the second volume of Galilei. Besides that, I finished the first volume of a biography of Emperor Charles V yesterday, and I still have to work out the many genealogical charts I've collected and the notes I've taken. Next, I have 3 pages of foreign words from my various books, all of which have to be written down, memorized, and read aloud. Number 4, my movie stars are in a terrible disarray and are dying to be straightened out, but since it'll take several days to do that, and Professor Anne is, as she's already said, up to her ears in work, they'll have to put up with the chaos a while longer. Then, there are Theseus, Oedipus, Peleus, Orpheus, Jason, and Hercules all waiting to be untangled, since their various deeds are running crisscross through my mind like multicolored threads in a dress. Myron and Phidias are also urgently in need of attention, or else I'll forget entirely how they fit into the picture. The same applies, for example, to the 7 Years' War and the 9 Years' War. Now I'm getting everything all mixed up. Well, what can you do with a memory like mine? Just imagine how forgetful I'll be when I'm 80. Oh, one more thing, the Bible. How long is it going to take before I come to the story of the bathing Susanna? And what do they mean by Sodom and Gomorrah? Oh, there's still so much to find out and learn. And in the meantime, I've left Charlotte of the Palatine in the lurch. You can see, can't you, Kitty, that I'm full to bursting. And now something else. You've known for a long time that my greatest wish is to be a journalist, and later on a famous writer. We'll have to wait and see if these grand illusions, or delusions, will ever come true. But up to now, I've had no lack of topics. In any case, after the war, I'd like to publish a book called The Secret Annex. It remains to be seen whether I'll succeed, but my diary can serve as the basis. I also need to finish Katie's life. I've thought up the rest of the plot. After being cured in the sanatorium, Katie goes back home and continues writing to Hans. It's 1941, and it doesn't take her long to discover Hans's Nazi sympathies. And since Katie is deeply concerned with the plight of the Jews and of her friend Marianne, they begin drifting apart. They meet and get back together, but break up when Hans takes up with another girl. Katie is shattered, and because she wants to have a good job, she studies nursing. After graduation, she accepts a position, at the urging of her father's friends, as a nurse in a TB sanatorium in Switzerland. During her first vacation, she goes to Lake Como, where she runs into Hans. He tells her that 2 years earlier, he'd married Katie's successor, but that his wife took her life in a fit of depression. Now that he's seen his little Katie again, he realizes how much he loves her, and once more asks for her hand in marriage. Katie refuses, even though, in spite of herself, she loves him as much as ever, but her pride holds her back. Hans goes away, and years later, Katie learns that he's wound up in England, where he's struggling with ill health. When she's 27, Katie marries a well-to-do man from the country named Simon. She grows to love him, but not as much as Hans. She has 2 daughters and a son, Lillian, Judith, and Nico. She and Simon are happy together, but Hans is always in the back of her mind until one night she dreams of him and says farewell. It's not sentimental nonsense. It's based on the story of Father's life. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, May 13th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, yesterday was Father's birthday, Father and Mother's 19th wedding anniversary, a day without the cleaning lady, and the sun was shining as it's never shone before in 1944. Our chestnut tree is in full bloom. It's covered with leaves and is even more beautiful than last year. Father received a biography of Linnaeus from Mr. Kleiman, a book on nature from Mr. Kugler, The Canals of Amsterdam from Dussel, a huge box from the Van Dans, wrapped so beautifully it might have been done by a professional, containing 3 eggs, a bottle of beer, a jar of yogurt, and a green tie. It made our jar of molasses seem rather paltry. My roses smelled wonderful compared to Meep and Bep's red carnations. He was thoroughly spoiled. 50 petits fours arrived from Simon's bakery. Delicious. Father also treated us to spice cake, the men to beer, and the ladies to yogurt. Everything was scrumptious. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, May 16th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, just for a change, since we haven't had one of these in so long, I'll recount a little discussion between Mr. and Mrs. Van D. last night. Mrs. Van D. The Germans have had plenty of time to fortify the Atlantic Wall, and they'll certainly do everything within their power to hold back the British. It's amazing how strong the Germans are.
Mr. Van D. Oh, yes, amazing.
Mrs. Van D. It is!
Mr. Van D. So strong they're bound to win the war in the end, is that what you mean?
Mrs. Van D. They might. I'm not convinced they won't.
Mr. Van D. I won't even answer that.
Mrs. Van D. You always wind up answering. You let yourself get carried away every single time.
Mr. Van D. No, I don't. I always keep my answers to the bare minimum.
Mrs. Van D. But you always do have an answer, and you always have to be right. Your predictions hardly ever come true, you know.
Mr. Van D. So far they have.
Mrs. Van D. No, they haven't. You said the invasion was going to start last year. The Finns were supposed to have been out of the war by now. The Italian campaign ought to have been over by last winter. And the Russians should have already captured Lemberg. Oh, no, I don't set much store by your predictions.
Mr. Van D., leaping to his feet.
Why don't you shut your trap for a change? I'll show you who's right. Someday you'll get tired of needling me. I can't stand your belly aching a minute longer. Just wait. One day I'll make you eat your words. End of Act One.
Actually, I couldn't help giggling. Mother couldn't either, and even Peter was biting his lips to keep from laughing. Oh, those stupid grown-ups. They need to learn a few things first before they start making so many remarks about the younger generation. Since Friday, we've been keeping the windows open again at night. Yours, Anne M. Frank. What our annex family is interested in. A systematic survey of courses and reading matter. Mr. Van Dam. No courses. Looks up many things in Naur's Encyclopedia and Lexicon. Likes to read detective stories, medical books, and love stories, exciting or trivial. Mrs. Van Dan, a correspondence course in English, likes to read biographical novels and occasionally other kinds of novels. Mr. Frank, is learning English, Dickens, and a bit of Latin, never reads novels, but likes serious, rather dry descriptions of people and places. Mrs. Frank, a correspondence course in English, reads everything except detective stories. Mr. Dussel, is learning English, Spanish, and Dutch with no noticeable results. Reads everything, goes along with the opinion of the majority. Peter Van Dan, is learning English, French, correspondence course, shorthand in Dutch, English, and German, commercial correspondence in English, woodworking, economics, and sometimes math. Seldom reads, sometimes geography. Margot Frank. Correspondence courses in English, French, and Latin, shorthand in English, German and Dutch, trigonometry, solid geometry, mechanics, physics, chemistry, algebra, geometry, English literature, French literature, German literature, Dutch literature, bookkeeping, geography, modern history, biology, economics, reads everything, preferably on religion and medicine. Anne Frank, shorthand in French, English, German, and Dutch. Geometry, algebra, history, geography, art history, mythology, biology, Bible history, Dutch literature, likes to read biographies, dull or exciting, and history books. Sometimes novels and light reading. Friday, May 19th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I felt rotten yesterday. Vomiting, me of all people. Headache, stomach ache, and anything else you can imagine. I'm feeling better today. I'm famished, but I think I'll skip the beans we're having for dinner. Everything's going fine between Peter and me. The poor boy has an even greater need for tenderness than I do. He still blushes every evening when he gets his goodnight kiss, and then begs for another one. Am I merely a better substitute for Bosch? I don't mind. He's so happy just knowing somebody loves him. After my laborious conquest, I've distanced myself a little from the situation, but you mustn't think my love has cooled. Peter's a sweetheart, but I've slammed the door to my inner self. If he ever wants to force the lock again, he'll have to use a harder crowbar. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, May 20th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, last night when I came down from the attic, I noticed, the moment I entered the room, that the lovely vase of carnations had fallen over. Mother was down on her hands and knees mopping up the water, and Margot was fishing my papers off the floor. What happened? I asked with anxious foreboding, and before they could reply, I assessed the damage from across the room. My entire genealogy file, my notebooks, my books, everything was afloat. I nearly cried, and I was so upset I started speaking German. I can't remember a word, but according to Margot, I babbled something about
Unüberseber, schadenschrecklich, einsichtlich, nicht zu ersetzen,
and much more. Father burst out laughing, and Mother and Margot joined in, but I felt like crying because all my work and elaborate notes were lost. I took a closer look, and luckily, the incalculable loss wasn't as bad as I'd expected. Up in the attic, I carefully peeled apart the sheets of paper that were stuck together and then hung them on the clothesline to dry. It was such a funny sight, even I had to laugh. Maria de' Medici alongside Charles V, William of Orange, and Marie Antoinette.
It's Rassenschande,
Mr. Van Dam joked. After entrusting my papers to Peter's care, I went back downstairs. Which books are ruined? I asked Margot, who was going through them. Algebra, Margot said. But as luck would have it, my algebra book wasn't entirely ruined. I wish it had fallen right in the vase. I've never loathed any book as much as that one. Inside the front cover are the names of at least 20 girls who had it before I did. It's old, yellowed, full of scribbles, crossed-out words, and revisions. The next time I'm in a wicked mood, I'm going to tear the darned thing to pieces. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, May 22, 1944. Dearest Kitty, on May 20th, Father lost his bet and had to give 5 jars of yogurt to Mrs. Van Dam. The invasion still hasn't begun. I can safely say that all of Amsterdam, all of Holland, in fact the entire western coast of Europe, all the way down to Spain, are talking about the invasion day and night, debating, making bets, and hoping. The suspense is rising to fever pitch. By no means has everyone we think of as good Dutch people kept their faith in the English. Not everyone thinks the English bluff is a masterful strategical move. Oh no, people want deeds, great heroic deeds. No one can see farther than the end of their nose. No one gives a thought to the fact that the British are fighting for their own country and their own people. Everyone thinks it's England's duty to save Holland as quickly as possible. What obligations do the English have toward us? What have the Dutch done to deserve the generous help they so clearly expect? Oh no, the Dutch are very much mistaken. The English, despite their bluff, are certainly no more to blame for the war than all the other countries, large and small, that are now occupied by the Germans. The British are not about to offer their excuses. True, they were sleeping during the years Germany was rearming itself, but all the other countries, especially those bordering on Germany, were asleep too. England and the rest of the world have discovered that burying your head in the sand doesn't work, and now each of them, especially England, is having to pay a heavy price for its ostrich policy. No country sacrifices its men without reason, and certainly not in the interests of another, and England is no exception. The invasion, liberation, and freedom will come someday, yet England, not the occupied territories, will choose the moment. To our great sorrow and dismay, we've heard that many people have changed their attitude toward us Jews. We've been told that anti-Semitism has cropped up in circles where once it would have been unthinkable. This fact has affected us all very, very deeply. The reason for the hatred is understandable, maybe even human, but that doesn't make it right. According to the Christians, the Jews are blabbing their secrets to the Germans, denouncing their helpers and causing them to suffer the dreadful fate and punishments that have already been meted out to so many. All of this is true, but as with everything, they should look at the matter from both sides. Would Christians act any differently if they were in our place? Could anyone, regardless of whether they're Jews or Christians, remain silent in the face of German pressure? Everyone knows it's practically impossible, so why do they ask the impossible of the Jews? It's being said in underground circles that the German Jews who immigrated to Holland before the war and have now been sent to Poland shouldn't be allowed to return here. They were granted the right to asylum in Holland, but once Hitler is gone, they should go back to Germany. When you hear that, you begin to wonder why we're fighting this long and difficult war. We're always being told that we're fighting for freedom, truth, and justice. The war isn't even over, and already there's dissension, and Jews are regarded as lesser beings. Oh, it's sad, very sad, that the old adage has been confirmed for the umpteenth time. What one Christian does is his own responsibility. What one Jew does reflects on all Jews. To be honest, I can't understand how the Dutch, a nation of good, honest, upright people, can sit in judgment on us the way they do. On us, the most oppressed, unfortunate, and pitiable people in all the world. I have only one hope, that this anti-Semitism is just a passing thing, that the Dutch will show their true colors, that they'll never waver from what they know in their hearts to be just, for this is unjust. And if they ever carry out this terrible threat, the meager handful of Jews still left in Holland will have to go. We too will have to shoulder our bundles and move on, away from this beautiful country, which once so kindly took us in and now turns its back on us. I love Holland. Once I hoped it would become a fatherland to me, since I had lost my own. And I hope so still. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Thursday, May 25th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Bep's engaged. The news isn't much of a surprise, though none of us are particularly pleased. Bertus may be a nice, steady, athletic young man, but Bep doesn't love him, and to me that's enough reason to advise her against marrying him. Bep's trying to get ahead in the world, and Bertus is pulling her back. He's a laborer, without any interest or any desire to make something of himself, and I don't think that'll make Bep happy. I can understand Bep's wanting to put an end to her indecision. 4 weeks ago, she decided to write him off, but then she felt even worse. So she wrote him a letter, and now she's engaged. There are several factors involved in this engagement. First, Bep's sick father, who likes Bertus very much. Second, she's the oldest of the Foschool girls, and her mother teases her about being an old maid. Third, she's just turned 24, and that matters a great deal to Bep. Mother said it would have been better if Bep had simply had an affair with Bertus. I don't know. I feel sorry for Bep and can understand her loneliness. In any case, they can get married only after the war, since Bertus is in hiding, or at any rate has gone underground. Besides, they don't have a penny to their name and nothing in the way of a hope chest. What a sorry prospect for Bep, for whom we all wish the best. I only hope Bertus improves under her influence, or that Bep finds another man, one who knows how to appreciate her. Yours, Anne M. Frank. The same day. There's something happening every day. This morning, Mr. Van Hoven was arrested. He was hiding two Jews in his house. It's a heavy blow for us, not only because those poor Jews are once again balancing on the edge of an abyss, but also because it's terrible for Mr. Van Hoven. The world's been turned upside down. The most decent people are being sent to concentration camps, prisons, and lonely cells, while the lowest of the low rule over young and old, rich and poor. One gets caught for black marketeering, another for hiding Jews or other unfortunate souls. Unless you're a Nazi, you don't know what's going to happen to you from one day to the next. Mr. Van Hoven is a great loss to us, too. Bep can't possibly lug such huge amounts of potatoes all the way here, nor should she have to. So our only choice is to eat fewer of them. I'll tell you what we have in mind, but it's certainly not going to make life here any more agreeable. Mother says we'll skip breakfast, eat hot cereal and bread for lunch and fried potatoes for dinner and, if possible, vegetables or lettuce once or twice a week. That's all there is. We're going to be hungry, but nothing's worse than being caught. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, May 26th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, at long, long last, I can sit quietly at my table before the crack in the window frame and write you everything, everything I want to say. I feel more miserable than I have in months. Even after the break-in, I didn't feel so utterly broken inside and out. On the one hand, there's the news about Mr. Van Hoven, the Jewish question, which is discussed in detail by everyone in the house, the invasion, which is so long in coming, the awful food, the tension, the miserable atmosphere, my disappointment in Peter. On the other hand, there's Bep's engagement, the Pentecost reception, the flowers, Mr. Kugler's birthday, cakes and stories about cabarets, movies and concerts. That gap, that enormous gap, is always there. One day we're laughing at the comical side of life in hiding, and the next day, and there are many such days, we're frightened, and the fear, tension, and despair can be read on our faces. Meep and Mr. Kugler bear the greatest burden for us, and for all those in hiding. Meep in everything she does, and Mr. Kugler through his enormous responsibility for the eight of us, which is sometimes so overwhelming that he can hardly speak from the pent-up tension and strain. Mr. Kleiman and Bep also take very good care of us, but they're able to put the annex out of their minds, even if it's only for a few hours or a few days. They have their own worries, Mr. Kleiman with his health and Bep with her engagement, which isn't looking very promising at the moment. But they also have their outings, their visits with friends, their everyday lives as ordinary people, so that the tension is sometimes relieved, if only for a short while ours never is, never has been, not once in the 2 years we've been here. How much longer will this increasingly oppressive, unbearable weight press down on us? The drains are clogged again. We can't run the water, or, if we do, only a trickle. We can't flush the toilet, so we have to use a toilet brush, and we've been putting our dirty water into a big earthenware jar. We can manage for today, but what will happen if the plumber can't fix it on his own? The sanitation department can't come until Tuesday. Meep sent us a raisin bread with Happy Pentecost written on top. It's almost as if she were mocking us, since our moods and cares are far from happy. We've all become more frightened since the Van Hoven business. Once again you hear shh from all sides, and we're doing everything more quietly. The police forced the door there. They could just as easily do that here, too. What will we do if we're ever... No, I mustn't write that down. But the question won't let itself be pushed to the back of my mind today. On the contrary, all the fear I've ever felt is looming before me in all its horror. I had to go downstairs alone at 8 this evening to use the bathroom. There was no one down there, since they were all listening to the radio. I wanted to be brave, but it was hard. I always feel safer upstairs than in that huge, silent house, when I'm alone with those mysterious, muffled sounds from upstairs and the honking of horns in the street. I have to hurry and remind myself where I am to keep from getting the shivers. Meep has been acting much nicer toward us since her talk with Father, but I haven't told you about that yet. Meep came up one afternoon all flushed and asked Father straight out if we thought they too were infected with the current anti-Semitism. Father was stunned and quickly talked her out of the idea, but some of Meep's suspicion has lingered on. They're doing more errands for us now and showing more of an interest in our troubles, though we certainly shouldn't bother them with our woes. Oh, they're such good, noble people. I've asked myself again and again whether it wouldn't have been better if we hadn't gone into hiding, if we were dead now and didn't have to go through this misery, especially so that the others could be spared the burden. But we all shrink from this thought. We still love life. We haven't yet forgotten the voice of nature, and we keep hoping, hoping for everything. Let something happen soon, even an air raid. Nothing can be more crushing than this anxiety. Let the end come, however cruel. At least then we'll know whether we are to be the victors or the vanquished. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, May 31st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, it was too hot to hold my fountain pen, which is why I couldn't write to you. Friday, the drains were clogged. Saturday, they were fixed. Mrs. Kleiman came for a visit in the afternoon and told us a lot about Yopi. She and Jacques von Marzen are in the same hockey club. Sunday, Bep dropped by to make sure there hadn't been a break-in and stayed for breakfast. Monday, a holiday because of Pentecost, Mr. Geese served as the annex watchman. And Tuesday, we were finally allowed to open the windows. We've seldom had a Pentecost weekend that was so beautiful and warm. Or maybe hot is a better word. Hot weather is horrible in the annex. To give you an idea of the numerous complaints, I'll briefly describe these sweltering days. Saturday. Wonderful! What fantastic weather, we all said in the morning. If only it weren't quite so hot, we said in the afternoon, when the windows had to be shut. Sunday. The heat's unbearable. The butter's melting. There's not a cool spot anywhere in the house. The bread's drying out. The milk's going sour. The windows can't be opened. We poor outcasts are suffocating, while everyone else is enjoying their Pentecost, according to Mrs. Van D. Monday. My feet hurt, I have nothing cool to wear, I can't do the dishes in this heat. Grumbling from early in the morning to late at night, it was awful. I can't stand the heat. I'm glad the wind's come up today, but that the sun's still shining. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, June 2nd, 1944. Dear Kitty, if you're going to the attic, take an umbrella with you, preferably a large one. This is to protect you from household showers. There's a Dutch proverb, high and dry, safe and sound. But it obviously doesn't apply to wartime, guns, and to people in hiding, cat box. Mushi's gotten into the habit of relieving herself on some newspapers or between the cracks in the floorboards, so we have good reason to fear the splatters and, even worse, the stench. The new Mortje in the warehouse has the same problem. Anyone who's ever had a cat that's not housebroken can imagine the smells, other than pepper and thyme, that permeate this house. I also have a brand new prescription for gunfire jitters. When the shooting gets loud, proceed to the nearest wooden staircase. Run up and down a few times, making sure to stumble at least once. What with the scratches and the noise of running and falling, you won't even be able to hear the shooting, much less worry about it. Yours truly has put this magic formula to use. With great success. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, June 5th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, new problems in the annex. A quarrel between Dussel and the Franks over the division of butter. Capitulation on the part of Dussel. Close friendship between the latter and Mrs. Van Dam. Flirtations, kisses, and friendly little smiles. Dussel is beginning to long for female companionship. The Van Dans don't see why we should bake a spice cake for Mr. Kugler's birthday when we can't have one ourselves. All very petty. Mood upstairs? Bad. Mrs. Van D has a cold. Dussel caught with brewer's yeast tablets, while we've got none. The Fifth Army has taken Rome. The city neither destroyed nor bombed. Great propaganda for Hitler. Very few potatoes and vegetables. One loaf of bread was moldy. Scharminkelche, name of new warehouse cat, can't stand pepper. She sleeps in the cat box and does her business in the wood shavings. Impossible to keep her. Bad weather. Continuous bombing. of Pas-de-Calais, and the west coast of France. No one buying dollars, gold even less interesting. The bottom of our black money box is in sight. What are we going to live on next month? Yours, Anne M. Frank.